All right, let's go to the break. When the Shilling Show returns, it is David Murata with Murata Wealth Management. And we're going to be talking about what is the most dangerous power, and government, yes, indeed, has a lot to do with it. Stay with us. The Shilling Show back in a moment. 977-1070, that's the phone number here on The Shilling Show, and Bruce is standing by in master control, taking your calls politely and professionally. Comments, questions, challenges. Our guest today is David Murata. You read his column weekly on Monday in the business section of the daily newspaper, and he has such a large readership, and I think it's just wonderful that he comes in here to share with us as well on this radio broadcast each and every month. And David Murata, welcome back to The Shilling Show.
Thank you so much for having me again.
All right, looks like we have you on a different microphone, so let me put you up there and take you down here, and there he is. And so today we're talking about what power is the most dangerous? And it's funny, we were talking about power, but it was electrical power, and you're not talking about downed electrical lines today, I take it.
No, we're talking about power in society. Yeah, it's interesting that liberals and conservatives continue to talk past each other with the same words and meaning very different things by them. For liberals, their definition of power is whenever one person can have any influence over another person, they define that as power. So if Warren Buffett were to come to you and say, Rob, I want you to come work for me. Mm-hmm. You need to give up that radio stuff, but I'm going to pay you $2 million a year.
Okay.
Right. Exactly. And liberals will view that as Warren Buffett having power over you. Now, if Warren Buffett really, really wants to get you and you say, look, I'm not willing to come work for you unless you pay me $2 million a year, liberals are a little reticent to say, well, I guess that's power. I guess you have power over him. But they always view power as a one-sided street from employee to employer or from big something to small little guy. And it's always a David and Goliath story.
Yeah, I don't see that. I mean, maybe it's just because my mind is set in a certain way. But I mean, I have the choice. And I know we're going to get into this later. But he doesn't have any power over me. If I wanted to keep doing this show, I would say, fine, I'll keep doing it. You know, it's all about money. And if I decided that I wanted to and there was a certain dollar threshold, then I'm making the choice, not him.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there's a dollar threshold that I would go work for someone else so long as it wasn't illegal.
Yes.
You know, I have a certain integrity that supersedes money, but I also have a value for what you can do with money, and there's probably a monetary amount that I would go work for someone else. So, you know, and it's different for different people depending upon their circumstances, and that's why you call it choice. You have a choice, and if you have other options that are lucrative, then your price, if you will, to go work for someone else mm-hmm. is a lot higher than if you have no other options. So that's the liberal view of power is what I would call influence, or you might call it reward power. Mm-hmm. Anytime I can reward you for doing something, then I have power over you. For conservatives, it's not power unless it's a restriction of the choices I already have. So if I'm involved in some process, if I have the same choices before and after you do something, you haven't influenced, you haven't exerted power over me. You might have exerted influence. And so long as you don't restrict my choices, then I still have the same powers as I did before. And so for conservatives, it's much more, instead of influence or reward power, it's much more coercive power. That is, you can coerce me either to do something or not do something. So if you've taken away my choices or you've forced me to do something, then that's the power that's really dangerous. That's the power that really deserves the title power.
It does. And again, this all seems so backward to me that somebody would think that restricting my choices was empowering me and that somebody else was abusing their power by making me an offer that I couldn't refuse, so to speak.
That's right. And economic influence is probably what we would call the liberal definition of power. And because they think that explains most of what happens in society is they would say that most of society is explained by the deliberate exertion of power. And all of the unhappy social circumstances result from someone's exertion of power. So if only we could take all of that power that these people have and influence that these people have, if only we could take that and harness it for the public good by forcing them to use it for other people's good, that's really what will bring about solutions in society to the problems we have.
But that's frightening because that's impinging upon my rights. We had a guy on here who ran for city council as a socialist, and he comes in here every once in a while, Brandon Collins. And we were talking about this, and he was talking about his vision of society. And essentially, it involved, ultimately, his people, the other socialists and Marxists here in Charlottesville, to go over to Barracks Road. And I'm just using that as an example because it came up. and basically occupy those businesses. And if the business owners would not capitulate, they would not leave, and they would essentially take over these businesses by force. And we know that the force would be violence.
Right. So that goes back to what's the most dangerous power. For liberals, it's this exerting influence. And if they were to answer the question, do you have property rights, they would tend towards saying, no, those property rights are limited, or they're certainly not absolute. There's things you can't do with your property, and there's things you must do with your property. And so property rights under a liberal view are very, very weak. They tend toward the answer no, although they'll say yes, but, and they'll always add the but in there to try to say actually no. Whereas with conservatives, the answer is yes, you have the right to your own property.
I want to get back to the root of this, because we're talking about liberals and progressives, but where this really comes from is from Karl Marx, right? I mean, this whole idea that everything is economics and this is where the power is and so forth, that's built on a foundation of Marxist principles, right?
It all comes down to whether the ends justify the means. And for liberals, the ends of equality are so important that it allows more intervention on the means for coercion. And you have to understand, for liberals, this is completely within their worldview. I say it pejoratively like that, but to them, what needs to happen is for people who, with sincerity and articulated knowledge and reason, need to be put in charge of all of the resources so that they use it for societal's good. And they believe that because this influence has such a great control and influence in society, and because it solves most of the world's problems, that if you only did that, you'd actually be able to solve the world's problems. Conservatives don't think you could solve the problems even if you had angels in charge of all this, because they don't think that power has much of an explanatory role, and therefore fewer sweeping reforms can actually achieve their goals. And so to get to the conservative view, conservatives think that there are these systemic processes and incentives, and if you can put processes and incentives in place for societal good, then you'll get the best chance of having the best society you can in a fallen world in which all of us are broken and sinful people.
Yeah, that's so true. And I want to get to that on the other side of the break, but we've got about 45 seconds to just give a couple of examples of the sort of processes that you're talking about putting into place.
Well, any process that has incentives in place. So for Milton Friedman, he always said that when the same person pays for something, benefits from it, and decides whether or not it should be purchased, that's the only time when you have the negative feedback of balancing the cost of something with the benefit of something. So if I have to pay for medical services and I will benefit from those medical services, I'm the one that has to judge the cost-benefit analysis and decide whether or not it's worth it. But anytime you break it up and someone else is paying for it and I'm benefiting from it, then you get out of control spiraling costs for any kind of a government program.
Yeah, it's kind of like, as my wife says sometimes, gosh, what if we went out to dinner and there were no prices on the menu, you know, because somebody else was paying for it? We'd be eating lobster every night, but when we have to pay for it, we might get the ground beef or the chipped beef or something one night instead.
And that's why food insurance is even worse than medical insurance.
977-1070 is the phone number. We're talking about what power is the most dangerous when we talk about government. We'll take your calls at 977-1070 with David Murata on the other side of the news. Stay with us. In what was very nearly the theme song of The Shilling Show until my wife said, no, no more Mr. Nice Guy cannot be your theme song. But it was the very close runner-up to Taking It to the Streets. And I gotta love it. Thanks for joining us here weekdays from noon to 2. All points of view are welcome. We're talking about the power of government, and there comes an incoming call right now as we speak at 977-1070. We want to hear from you, your comments, questions, or challenges. We're talking with David Murata and kind of looking at this liberal versus conservative point of view in looking at the power of government and how we see things. I think it's a fascinating conversation. We need to talk about this and to think about it more often to really understand what those differences are. Gary is on the line. Let us say hello. Gary, welcome to The Shilling Show, and you're on with David Murata.
Thank you, Rob, for taking my call. David, can you comment on the continuing Eurozone crisis and what you might be advising people about it? I wonder if you felt is the... problems there contagious to our banking system in the U.S.?
Now let's get a response. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question, Gary. There's a talk I did a while ago on the Eurozone. I think it's been almost a year now in countries with economic freedom. But the Eurozone's problem is solved if they just print enough euros. Our government debt problem is solved if we just print $15 trillion. And what that means is that government will solve the problem. The problem in the Eurozone is that they can't do that legally. Mm-hmm. So they have to do it sort of underhandedly. And what they've done is they've funded the European Super Lending Fund, and it gets sort of free money, and then it borrows the money at 0% interest, and then it loans it all to all the banks at a little bit of interest, and then the banks loan it out at a bigger interest, and so everyone makes money off money that isn't really there, which is the equivalent of printing money, but it circumvents their legal constraint and inability to do so. What that means is that the euro will continue to decline in value against other currencies. The problem is that the U.S. dollar will also continue to decline in value against mm-hmm. other currencies as well. So they're both going down. And so we tend to overweight, for most investment firms, emerging market debt. And there's two reasons to invest in the emerging market bonds. One is they're not euros, and the second is they're not dollars. So they also pay a great percentage of return. Emerging market debt to GDP ratios at about 40%. For developed countries, it's at 100%. It's dropped to 40% because the emerging market countries continue to emerge and their GDP continues to grow. So that's the first thing. On the fixed income side, we tend to overweight emerging market debt more than most investment advisory firms. And I say that it's probably a quarter of our foreign bond allocation, which is higher than most firms probably have. The second is to invest in countries with high economic freedom and low debt and deficit. So this would avoid the 61% of the foreign EFI index that has high debt and deficit. So we invest a lot in the other 39% and in emerging markets. And that would mean countries, the top six are Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, Switzerland, and Canada. Canada's debt is getting up there a little bit, but it's still not quite as bad as the United States and Europe. So those six countries have high economic freedom and low debt and deficit. And we think that's a better choice, too. It just goes to show you how much these systemic things actually have more influence than all of the government pronouncements from Europe and the United States on economic growth.
And thank you so much for the call, Gary. And I think it's interesting, as you listed those top countries for economic freedom, that the United States was not on there, although I'm sure it was at one time. And there wasn't a single country from the Eurozone either. So these are two countries that are going down the liberal path that we're talking about, constraining freedoms and bigger government, and look where it's gotten them, to utter failure.
Yes, most of economic freedom declined this past year. The United States fell out of the most free category, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. And it's still at the top of the mostly free, the United States, but it's... But, you know, going from free to mostly free is just an insult to the country that basically invented freedom.
Yeah, you're going in the wrong direction. And this leads, and by the way, there's a line open for you right now at 977-1070. This leads, David Murata, just beautifully into a question by our friend Ken the Democrat, who writes in, why do individual rights trump the good of the community? Where is that written? Where is it written that you have a right to everything you earn under a free market capitalist system? Did you give yourself brains, health, and opportunity? Let's take that one head on. The first one, why do individual rights trump the good of the community, and where is that written?
Yeah, it's a great question. The individual rights and property rights are probably the most basic rights historically. If you look at the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal assumes mm-hmm. that you actually own something and have the property rights to that. So it tends to be a very, very old idea. The answer I would give to Gary is that when everyone—
That's Ken the Democrat,
Ken,
by the
sorry,
way. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, Gary, completely. The answer I would give to Ken is that when everyone owns something, no one actually is making the decision because they're trying to use it for their own benefit and it doesn't cost them anything. So when I produce something and you get to use it, It's the fun of spending other people's money, and there's no negative feedback. There's no constraint on it. Conservatives think that these incentives and processes and systemic processes are terribly, terribly important, and Ken is completely throwing those out the window and saying, hey, what you really need is you really need rational human beings with sincerity and articulated knowledge and reason, and somehow these people will be saints and angels. And it's just not true. Historically, all of the evidence is against people in power using things for other people's good altruistically in a responsible manner, looking at what it costs. There's that experiment has been run probably 600 times in history. And if you're a student of history, you see that it never works. It completely goes down the wrong path. Costs spiral out of control. So it turns out in a fallen, broken society in which each of us tend towards selfishness, these systemic processes and incentives have a much greater chance of producing wealth for all than in terms of free trade, where you and I don't get to exchange anything unless both of us are benefited by it and both of us think it's a good idea, than they do with an altruistic utopian view of human nature.
I think this is so important because I know Ken is a Christian, and going back to the Ten Commandments and thou shalt not steal, and also coveting, I think, is another part of this, because you get a bunch of people, the do-gooders with this group Impact, that get the churches together and encourage coveting from the pulpit, taking what belongs to somebody else instead of going to their church and saying, hey, let's do this through the church.
Yeah, and it's interesting. What I would say is the liberal and conservatives' impulses are built into our brains, and there is a time for each one of them. And that's actually something that I think is important for both liberals and conservatives to recognize. The time for the liberal instinct is when you are voluntarily trying to decide if you want to be altruistic and help other people. As a coercive force of government, it is terrible. As a private charity impetus, it is beautiful. And so, and what I've seen is that, and I work with 200 families. What I've seen with my experience is that families of means and families not of means are both equally tend to have a tendency toward generosity, and that generosity is beautiful. And some people will work like the dog; they will work 80 hours a week simply to have more money to give away. But if you're going to take it from them and use it for your pet project, they will not give you a dime. They will resist it, and they won't even work hard for it. So they want to work for the charities they feel passionate about, and they're very generous people, and they have the best of intentions for that. But when you want to go waste it in the government on your funding of whatever your pet project is, that's not their pet project, and that's not what they get excited about.
Yeah, the forced giving at the point of a gun or the coercion of government is a disincentive for people to be charitable, and that's proven.
Yeah, and that goes to the liberal view of power. The liberal view of power is anytime you take away my choices. And that is the most dangerous view of the liberal view of power. They believe that when you take away my choices, you are using a coercive power, and they're very resistant to that. And along those lines, to worry about the so-called problem of economic influence and try to solve it by increasing and concentrating political power to a conservative is ludicrous. Because when you increase political power and you give power of the government has this coercive power, it is corrupting, and it means that it's going to be used for ill, and it's going to be used for ill in a terrible way. So the influences of government by big business, I think, are much more dangerous than the influence of big business.
And you know, I'm looking at the very first sentence of Ken the Democrat's email here. Why do individual rights trump the good of the community? Let's stop right there and put a period after the question mark and say, if it's good for the community, let's just say we have the Impact churches who say they want to commandeer Ken the Democrat's private residence because that's good for the community. I wonder how quickly he'd change sides, or if he would just go down with the ship and say, OK, come and take it. It's better for the community. You know, it's such an interesting first sentence or statement here. And it should be patently obvious to anybody who owns a business or who owns a property. Of course, your rights trump the rights of the community. And wait till they come. You know, first they came for the Catholics and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I'm assuming that Ken probably makes more than $34,000 a year. That puts him in the top 1% of wage earners in the world. So he's part of the 1%. Would he be willing to give up anything over, say, $10,000 of his income in order to help out the other 99% and try to equalize outcomes in society? I'm pretty sure that he thinks that he is a better steward and better able to figure out how to have an impact with his own money, because he would assume that he is part of those who are sincere with articulated knowledge and reason, capable of handling money, but he's not willing to concede that for the other side, for other people with money. And that's why he wants his influence to have the control over where the money goes. And he would then be the arbiter of what is societal's best good. And being the arbiter of what is societal's best good is, you know, the definition of slavery. I will decide what's in your best interest and for your best good, not you. And that's where it ends up. It ends up in the sort of societal slavery where I will tell you what your job will be, and I will tell you what you need to do for society, and I will take away your money and tell you what you can eat in the market and what you can't eat in the market. And I'll tell you, you know, today's meat is chicken because mm-hmm. beef costs too much, or better yet, it's tofu because meat costs too much, or better yet, you know, you must eat the rice and beans that I provide for you because that's healthier for you, and then your medical costs won't cost as much.
And this is where it always goes. History proves it out. There is no benevolent dictatorship, and there is no benevolent huge central government. It ultimately turns to tyranny every time.
And the question to Ken would be, what choices would you allow people in society?
Mm-hmm. Well,
because instead of all rights that are not enumerated to government, he would rather have only those rights that are enumerated to individuals are the ones that we would allow for them.
And that was the fear in putting forward the Bill of Rights, is that it would be construed that way. And unfortunately, it has gone in that direction. Not that we shouldn't have had the Bill of Rights, but I think the fears were founded. We're running very late for the break. David Marotta is our guest. 977-1070 is the phone number. We're talking about dangerous powers of government. And The Shilling Show, the final segment, right after this. As we head into the final segment of The Shilling Show, and what an important conversation. You know, we're talking about the power of government and what is dangerous about it and where it ultimately leads if we let loose on the reins too much, which I think we've done in this country. The results are not good there. And I think the underlying premise here is that we live in a fallen world, which we actually do, and most people would agree to that, and that we have a lot of troubles in this world that are due ultimately to the sinful nature of man. So we have a couple things we want to get to before we run out of time here, and let's talk about legal boundaries. Anything goes within these legal boundaries.
Yeah, the question that Ken raised raises a question that liberals and conservatives answer differently, and that is, within legal boundaries, can a property owner be irrational, arbitrary, capricious, even unjust? And liberals would say, no, he can't. And conservatives would say, yes, he can. That's the very definition of a legal boundary. To conservatives, a legal boundary or a line that the law says you shall not cross is a line. And the very meaning of a line is that you can go as close to it as you want so long as you don't cross it. Whereas liberals don't view laws as line, they view them as tools to be used to force you to do society's good. And so a liberal judge won't view a law as a line. He'll say, well, the intent of the law was to do something, and your very intent means this various intent means that because you don't have an equality of outcome, you're actually not doing the intent of the law. And even though you're not breaking any law by crossing a line, we're nevertheless going to force you to do something for society's good. And it's interesting to me that I get nowadays a lot more questions, what's wrong with socialism, or why should we have any rights, or why should individuals have any rights at all?
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, that scares me more than anything in the political debate, because that's not something in the 1950s during the Cold War we were having a whole lot of debate about. It was us versus the other side, and the other side was Soviet Russia, and Soviet Russia was making all of these arguments, and we were pretty much arguing against it. Nowadays, we're pretty much arguing for it, and I don't know who's arguing against it. Maybe China. it's become a lot stranger in society. China thinks we should now have a free market and some should grow rich first. They're just not so sure about these political rights. I think I'd turn around and ask Ken, why should we have political rights? Why should we have any rights at all? Wouldn't it be better to have a king than having all of this infighting in Congress? Wouldn't it be better just to have a benevolent king? Why don't we just elect a king for his lifetime and let him decide whatever is in the best interest of society?
you know, I think he's throwing you a softball here. He sent another response. He said, it's precisely because most of us, myself included, don't give enough to charity that as Christians we need to help the poor via government.
I think I would make the argument that government charity actually impoverishes people. There's been a number of studies. There's a whole book called When Helping Hurts, and that when you have a government induced charity, it is not charity. It is actually coercively collected, and then it is given out as an entitlement, and that's not charity. Charity, and the reason why private charities work where government charities don't, is that a private charity goes to someone and tries to figure out what's in their best interest. And if they are not working to help what is in their best interest, they don't give the charity. You can't do that with a government program. That's discriminatory, and it's trying to judge people's motives. And you can't judge people's motives. It's an entitlement. Whereas a charity can judge people's motives and decide to give or not to give based upon its own discretion of what's in that person's best interest. And that's why private charity works, is because it actually has teeth that helps people change their situation in a way that actually makes them better, that's hard to change otherwise without that incentive. And again, it works on incentives rather than force.
And by the way, I don't know if you have the numbers at hand, but I'm pretty sure we had this conversation in the past. Who gives more to charity, liberals or conservatives?
It turns out conservatives give a lot more to charity. Even if you take out the religious giving, they still give a lot more to charity. And I think it's because they believe in individualism, and they are basically, I don't want to say more generous, but they're more generous certainly with their own money, and they still pay the same taxes. So they have the same burden as liberals do, but they're more generous with it.
So maybe to answer Ken's question or his query, that precisely because most of us, myself included, don't give enough charity, that as Christians we need to help the poor via government, maybe if the liberals just stepped up to the conservative level of giving, that would solve some of our problems. David Marotta, we're out of time, but it's always a great conversation, and this one was so important. Thanks so much for joining us today. Give us your website real quickly.
Thank you so much for having me. It's maradaonmoney.com.
Lots of great information there, maradaonmoney.com. And we'll look forward to the next time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.